24th episode of the Arman and Akil Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Akil Krishnan.
And I'm Arman Rana. We're recording this on Thursday, the 30th of January, 2025, at 8:05 a.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus, located on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Han Camino-speaking Musqueam people.
Right, an emergency second episode on the upcoming Trump tariffs. So, Arman, why are we doing this?
Yeah, good question. Well, just for context, you know, Trump is promising to impose a 25% tariff on Canadian imports. He's also suggested that he is open to annexing Canada through the use of economic force. And yeah, I was walking through the library and I came across this book, and it really seemed to speak to the moment. And then it turned out it was published 2 years ago, which was quite surprising to me.
That's quite prescient, hey?
Yeah, totally. And
So just give me a little bit of, if you know this, what is economic force? What do you think it is?
I think it's tariffs until I guess Canada bends the knee. I guess that's how I interpreted it as I don't know.
So we have joining with us via telephone Dr. Kim Richard Nossel, who's a professor of Professor Emeritus in the Department of Political Studies and Center for International Defense Policy at Queen's University. He's also the author of the book that Arman mentioned, Canada Alone, Navigating a Post-American World. Professor Nossel, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, so just to start off, I just want to give our listeners some context about what this book was about. And I'll read the back of the book. So, quote, the American-led global order has been increasingly challenged by Chinese assertiveness and Russian revanchism. As we enter the new era of great power competition, Canadians tend to assume that the United States will continue to provide global leadership for the West. Canada Alone sketches the more dystopian future that is likely to result when the illiberal, anti-democratic, and authoritarian Make America Great Again movement regains power under the twin stresses of a reinvigorated American First policy and the purposeful abandonment of American global leadership. The West will likely fracture, leaving Canadians all alone with an increasingly dysfunctional United States. Canada Alone outlines what Canada will need to navigate this deeply unfamiliar post-American world. As I mentioned, the book was published in 2023. So thanks again for joining us, Professor. So what led you to write this book, and what were you seeing in the United States and the world that led you to believe we were headed for a post-American world?
Well, to be perfectly frank with you, this book was written in 2022, actually, and it emerged out of a concern that I had with what was going on in Canada at the time. And essentially, much of the discussion that we were having in 2022 in Canada was that, you know, the victory of Joe Biden in the 2020 elections had essentially eliminated the possibility of a Trump return. And I guess that I wrote the book because I worried about the possibility that Trump wasn't such an aberration. I mean, there are lots of folks who ended up thinking that Trump's victory in the 2016 elections was essentially a kind of a one-off, that just as Mr. Trump himself was hugely surprised by his victory that November, so too was the idea that once Biden was elected in 2020, that would be it. And so what I ended up doing was sort of trying to sketch out what life would be like if Trump returned. And to be quite frank, I was one of the things that got me thinking about this was a comment that a colleague from Tufts University, a guy called Daniel Dresner, passed at a conference that I was at, where he basically said that Trump had stressed the institutions of the West in his first term, and he wondered if the West could survive a second term of Trump. And so essentially this book is about what would happen if Trump and MAGA and the Make America Great Again movement was victorious in 2024. And so the book was written in 22. It was published in 2023. The book was sort of put to bed. In other words, the author doesn't have anything more to do with it in about March of 2023. So it's now quite out of date in some senses. As an explanation for the coming end of the American world and our transition into the post-American world, it remains a good survey. But you know, to be quite frank, when I was writing the book, I had no notion at all that Mr. Trump, once he was reelected, would turn the way he has turned since November into an imperialist, an expansionist, someone who has no difficulty at all in threatening friends and allies. And so that in parts, the book is a little out of date, but in parts it also stresses what we're likely to face in the future.
Yeah, I personally found it like every chapter I was reading in it seemed to actually speak a lot to the moment we are in a lot of ways. So yeah, I would credit you for that. I just want to take step back a bit and just ask you personal curiosity. What led you to this profession of becoming professor in international defense policy? You know, you were at some stage in your life, you were a young man similar to me and my co-host. How did you evolve into this kind of role? Into somebody who analyzes, Canada's role in the world as their profession.
Well, I was very lucky. My father worked for a couple of newspapers in Toronto, the Globe and Mail, and a newspaper that has long since passed, the Toronto Telegram. And he was sent to China in 1959-60, and he was sent to cover the war in Vietnam and the Cultural Revolution from Hong Kong in the later 1960s. And so I went to school in Beijing, I went to school in Hong Kong during that period. And I guess that being in Asia at that time, prompted a real interest in global politics. So when I went to university, I went to the U of T, I studied world politics. And initially, my idea was to apply to the Foreign Service to work as a Canadian diplomat. So I took the entrance exams. The Department of External Affairs, as Global Affairs Canada was called back then, they decided that I didn't really have what it takes to be a Canadian diplomat. And so I decided that if I couldn't do that, I would teach. And so I stayed on. I did a PhD at U of T and was lucky enough to get a job at McMaster teaching Canadian foreign and defense policy and international relations.
And so, it definitely, you have a very keen eye for this, obviously. So I wanted to dive in a little bit about in your experience in your analysis, how much weight would you put on the unique personality of Trump versus the, I think, broad growth of Trumpist type movements and Trumpism as a whole?
I think that you pose a very good question there, because I think that what we have to recognize is that Trump is truly unique. If you look at American politics, you can see that in fact, when people try and behave like Trump, they fall absolutely flat. I mean, Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, tried hard to replace Trump as the leader of the MAGA movement in the United States, and he failed miserably, and not just simply because he's not a terribly appealing politician, but just simply because he doesn't have what Trump has. Trump has been able to appeal to a broad swath of American voters. Now, how many precisely, we don't know, because, you know, if you think about it, 90 million American voters decided to stay home and not to vote. To be sure, some of those 90 million were votes that were suppressed, in particular in Republican-dominated states, where large numbers of voters were removed from the rolls. So I don't want to suggest that all 90 million just were simply, you know, couldn't be bothered to get out and vote. But the fact is that a huge number of Americans did not participate in the vote that led Trump to narrowly, and it must be said, narrowly win in 2020. But when Trump passes from the scene, as you know, he will eventually, perhaps sooner rather than later, because as you can tell from just simply listening to him, it's not altogether clear that he has a full command of his sensibilities. And so that when he passes from the scene, we're not going to see someone quite like him emerge. When he passes from the scene, and if it's not yet 2029, then the presidency will pass to J.D. Vance, and J.D. Vance is not at all like Trump. And I think that we need to absolutely keep in mind the notion that Trump is truly unique.
And once he passes, as you mentioned, the conditions that gave rise to him will still be around in the sense of how people are feeling about their economy or their country or their socioeconomic status of their family, their community. Do you think Canada is immune from this Trumpism? And if not, you know, how would Canadian Trumpism be different from the American one?
Well, I think that first of all, there's no one who is immune from sort of populist appeals. And as you know, Mr. Trump enjoys a certain amount of popularity in Canada. All you have to do is to look at the Freedom Convoy in 2022 and the large number of Canadians who were flying Trump flags in that protest. Huge number of Americans came up and flew their flags, but lots of Canadians were flying them too. But the reality is that Trumpism in an American context is very, very particular. And I don't see any evidence that what flies in the United States would fly anywhere else in the liberal democratic world. I mean, you know, you can look at sort of far right movements in Europe, anti-immigration movements in Europe, and you just simply don't see the kind of particular elements that we see in with Trumpism in the United States. And it seems to me because that is because of what you noted before, the uniqueness of Mr. Trump himself, but also the uniqueness of the American polity that essentially creates a situation that allows someone who is a convicted felon, someone who has all of the attributes of Donald Trump, to be elected as president. And I just don't think you would find that in any other country in the world.
And what you know, one of the things to take this forward, one of the things that Trump has, you know, said he'll do recently is to, you know, is to slap tariffs on Canadian goods. And, you know, tariffs increase the price for U.S. imports. What do you think some of the ultimate effects of this are going to be, and how should Canada respond?
Well, I think that the first thing to do is to keep one's powder dry. Mr. Trump has a record of making over-the-top threats, claiming in a very hyperbolic way that he's going to do things. And always one has to recognize that there's a huge gap between the sort of the rambling idiocy of Mr. Trump's speech and the incompetence of Mr. Trump administration's actions. And so my own view is that we have to wait and see whether or not on the 1st of February, we actually get the kind of tariffs that Mr. Trump has been threatening. Or are we going to get a sort of a double-barreled hit? In other words, some tariffs on the 1st of February and other tariffs once the administration in Washington has looked at the trade and decided on another set of tariffs. And so my own view is that we need to wait and see. It doesn't mean we can't plan in response, but you've got to wait and see.
So it wouldn't, you're essentially saying that I think there have been some commentators who've said that we should go for a dollar for dollar tariff. You're saying that might not be the most effective way to fight
absolutely
this?
Absolutely not. Look, I mean, the thing is that there are certain aspects of the Canadian-American relationship that haven't changed, even with Trump in power. And the first thing that hasn't changed is that the relative size of the two economies stuck next to each other means that you do not want to get into a tit-for-tat quarrel with the United States in a kind of a dollar-for-dollar thing. Because, let's face it, if in fact Canada responds with a dollar-for-dollar tariff, all that that will do is prompt the MAGA crew around Mr. Trump just simply to tell him, Mr. President, just simply increase the tariffs. And if that happens, then the United States always has the capacity to retaliate in a more harmful fashion against Canada than Canada has the ability to do so. And so I just don't think, number one, that it's wise to get into that kind of tit for tat. The second reason why I'm hesitant is that it's not altogether clear what Mr. Trump has in mind here. I mean, much of our discussion in Canada on responding to the United States depends upon an assumption that all of this is very rational. And I guess that when I look at it, I don't see a lot of rationality at work here. I mean, Trump has a view of Canada that is just simply a babbling, incoherent mess, to be perfectly frank. I mean, he claims that Canada has a trade surplus with the United States of $200 billion. This is just a figure pulled totally out of the air, bears no relationship to reality at all. And so if, in fact, our discussions with Mr. Trump on the future of trade hang on a number that is simply pulled out of the air.
And which changes every time he speaks.
Well, absolutely. And it's, you know, it basically means nothing. The other thing is that we have absolutely no idea what will actually satisfy the Trump administration. We're told that, well, all you got to do is close your borders to fentanyl and that'll solve the problem. And I must admit, I'm not at all sure that if we close up that little bit of fentanyl that's coming in, that all of a sudden Trump is going to change his view and say, oh, yeah, well, now Canada's a friend. Because one of the things that we can absolutely see is that Trump has no affection for America's friends and allies. All you have to do is to look at how Trump sees other countries, in particular, America's friends and allies over the last 80 years, and to recognize that he's not going to change his view. And he's not going to change his view just simply because someone, you know, sort of bends and kisses the ring.
So, you know, how should Canada position itself going forward, you know, given the instability we just discussed in the United States with these tariffs and, you know, other actions taken by President Trump, and also the rise of China? There's just a lot of news lately about DeepSeek and China's advances in AI. So, yeah, how should Canada be positioning itself in your view?
Well, I think that we don't have a lot of room to maneuver here. I think absolutely that Canada needs to respond to any kind of tariffs imposed on us. But we should respond not in the kind of dollar for dollar way that, for example, someone like Ontario's premier, Doug Ford, suggests, but simply because we have to respond, but also with no expectation that this is going to solve the problem. Instead, what it seems to me we have to do is to have to begin a national conversation about what it means when we can no longer count on the United States to be friendly as it has been in the last 80 years or so, with the exception of 2017 to 2021. That means that we're going to have to rethink what it means to live next to the United States in an era when the Americans, and in particular the government in Washington, no longer conceives of Canada as a friend. What we shouldn't do is, in my humble estimation, What we shouldn't do is simply bow to pressure from Washington. What we do need to do is to let as many Americans as possible know that their president is harming not only a friendly country, Canada, but also is harming Americans by imposing costs on them for the importation of Canadian goods and services. But what we as Canadians need to do is also think about, you know, sort of finally diversifying in a way that we chose not to do. I mean, we've been around this block before. In 1971, the Nixon administration imposed a 10% surcharge on all Canadian goods. And all of a sudden, Canadians woke up to the fact that the Americans had the ability essentially to impose all sorts of costs. And so that the Trudeau government, as it was then, the Pierre Trudeau government, decided to examine what our options were. Because of the problems of being so dependent on the United States. Well, the fact is that being dependent on the United States for our wealth is just so much easier than the alternatives. And so we spent the 1970s trying to diversify, and it just didn't happen. We were as dependent on the United States at the end of the 1970s as we were at the beginning. And then in the 1980s, we made the decision to essentially throw our lot in with the United States. We signed the free trade agreement with the U.S. in 88, and that was expanded to the North American free trade agreement beginning in 1993. Excuse me. And so I think that one of the things that we have to do is to recognize that our dependence, our economic dependence on the United States, works for us as long as the U.S. remains essentially friendly. But what we have now is an administration in Washington that is hostile. And I think that we need to recognize that word is an appropriate word to use. We have a president who is hostile towards America's friends and allies. Someone who takes, for example, one of America's closest friends in Latin America, Colombia, and has no difficulty at all in just simply using tariffs to threaten that close friend. Or to take a NATO ally like Denmark and threaten to tariff Denmark at a very high level, as he put it, if Denmark should be so rude as not to cede part of its territory to the United States. I mean, this is hostile stuff. It's also batshit crazy stuff. And that's why I said earlier that what we have to do is to recognize that we're in very unusual territory here.
Yeah, so you mentioned diversification earlier. When I first arrived in Canada as well, it was like 12 years ago, around that time, diversification from the United States was again somewhat of a theme. There were a lot of talks about increasing trade with China, and then maybe at some stage, to a less extent, India as well, and also Southeast Asia more broadly. But 10 to 12 years later, we are even more economically, culturally, and militarily connected, maybe even dependent on the United States. So why did diversification fail? And how do we avoid it failing in the future?
I think that diversification is really problematic in the Canadian case because of the deep integration of our two economies that began with all sorts of free trade agreements, limited free trade agreements in the 1950s with defense products, in the 1960s with autos and auto products, and of course after the free trade agreements, the North American free trade agreements. The fact is that it is so much easier for Canadians to make money dealing with the United States as a consequence of that integration. The fact is that the vast majority of Canadians speak the same language as Americans. We are physically close with a hugely well-developed transportation network. I mean, when you think about the ease with which autos, as they're put together, cross the border so many times on their way to final assembly, you get some sense of just how easy it is to be plugged into those productive capacities rather than to have to deal with, first of all, places at a distance, places that where there's a different language at work, where there are cultural differences. I mean, there's a sort of a logic to Canadian huge dependence on the United States, and a difficulty of actually breaking that dependence. I think it could be broken, but keep in mind that what we need to do is to think carefully about diversification. And what it means is that we need to think about where we want to sell our products, so that when the German chancellor comes over here looking for a market for natural gas, what we shouldn't do is do what Mr. Trudeau did, which was to basically flick Chancellor Scholz off. We need to think about expanding our markets into other places. And that's just problematic to do. And you can't change decades of inertial production capability overnight.
So, coming to Europe, you described like a multipolar world order in your book with like United States and China as the major world powers, and Europe and Russia also being major poles as in kind of the potential emerging world order. How would you account for the rise of the far right in Europe? And what do you think of those who would say that maybe we're heading for a post-European world as well?
Well, I must admit, I think that what we need to do is to reflect on what will likely happen to the far right movements in Europe. They're not going to go away, but are they going to be as dominant as we see the sort of the rise of the far right in the United States? And I think a lot of what will likely happen will depend largely on what will happen to the Europeans geostrategically. I mean, if in fact Mr. Trump pulls the United States out of NATO, I think that's going to happen because the fact is that he's now starting to talk about requiring NATO countries to spend 5% of their GDP on defense, which is fundamentally an impossibility. I mean, the United States, which spends more on its defense than the next 18 countries, is only spending 3.5% of its GDP. There's no way that the United States would make it to 5%. There's no way that any of the countries of Europe would make it to 5%, which means that what Mr. Trump is doing is setting himself up and the Americans up to basically say, see, the Europeans are just, they're free riding off us once again. We're going to leave Europe. Well, if the United States leaves Europe, and that's going to expose Europe to the Russians, because the Russians are quite clear in, certainly under Vladimir Putin, quite clear in their desire to push against the Europeans. And so perhaps what we'll see is a degree of European unity that we haven't really seen. But the idea is essentially that if the Europeans are threatened by Russia and the United States is back across the Atlantic on the other side, then perhaps the Europeans will organize themselves in a much more unified way. And let's face it, the Europeans have the population, they have the economic capacity to be a great power, far greater than the Russians, to be sure, and around the size of the United States. And so I think that if in fact Europe becomes more united, then the rise of the far right, which has essentially been a response to pressures of immigration, that's going to be in a very different situation.
So you don't think that, you know, potentially, you know, in Europe that, like, you know, Russia would just continue to increase, because the far right is also in some ways a proxy for the Russian Federation, right? And they would continue to kind of increase their hold over Europe in some way.
You could see that. Right now there are links there, absolutely. But the far right remains a very much a minor player. They can have an outsized influence, but relative to all of Europe, they remain relatively small.
So, Professor, I just want to bring it back to Canada and to the tariffs and the Trump administration's actions. I think something that we're hearing a lot of now is what individual Canadians can do in the face of this kind of this anti-Canadian sentiment in the United States and the posture of the administration that Canada is, has a $300, $400, $500, $600, $750 billion trade surplus with the United States. What should individual Canadians do about all of this?
Well, first of all, I think that it's an exaggeration to say that there's an anti-Canadian sentiment. Public opinion polls taken in the last couple of weeks in the United States show that Trump's idiocy doesn't enjoy a great deal of support among Americans, that most Americans aren't at all comfortable with their president being, sort of an expansionist of the kind that Trump has become since the election. And so I guess that my inclination is not to simply write off the United States and all Americans. Instead, I would very much focus on the administration, and of course, sort of the MAGA types who tend to take Trump both seriously and literally. Eventually, they, I'm assuming, will finally recognize just how conned and duped they have been by Mr. Trump. But essentially to assume now that all Americans are behind this, I think would be a mistake. And that's why one of the things I think that individual Canadians can do is to begin to think about where we need to go in the 2020s in global politics. I mean, in one of the things that I talk about in the book, which I think remains something that we should do, is we need to have a national conversation about our foreign policy, about where we're going to go. That is something that governments, both liberal and conservative, in the last 20 years have just simply avoided. The Harper government never talked about or discussed with Canadians where we should be. And the Trudeau government for the last 9 years has been utterly silent on the question of, well, where should we go, generally speaking, in international politics? The book, I echo a number of academic colleagues who basically say, hey, guys, it's time for a royal commission, the kind of royal commission that Trudeau Pair created back in the early 80s, to basically say, where should we as Canadians go in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s? We need that conversation again.
Professor, any closing thoughts?
No, other than just to keep always the eye on the gap between rhetoric and what the administration actually does.
Fair enough. We should, and especially with this current administration, is probably much, much more important than at any other time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think a good example of that was during Trump's first term, we actually saw an escalation in tensions between the United States and Russia. But, you know, there was some sort of personal relationship that was, increasing between Putin and Trump, a positive relationship. But actually, in terms of sanctions and military equipment to Ukraine, tensions actually continued to increase.
Right. It's absolutely right.
Thanks so much for joining us. You can find us at the Armonicle on Instagram and Twitter. So check us out there. If you like the show, please leave us a review on Spotify.
And the music for the show is composed with the inexorable musical talents of Sarah Pratt. Every note she writes is a gift to humanity, elevating our souls to heights we never knew existed. We do have some awesome shows with the set of guests lined up for you. Do continue to listen and subscribe. You can find all of our episodes on our podcast feeds. Do check them out.
Thanks so much again, Professor, for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.